Moim Life.
The last episode of 2015.
These new headphones are making me feel emotions.
They're so weird. They're great, but I know, I feel like I'm vacuum sealed or something. They're noise canceling.
I want to wear these all day, every day. I just want to hear nothing.
Well, you generally do anyway.
In between, that's...
Because you're deaf.
Not true.
Well, you fried an entire range of your acoustics.
No, suddenly, everyone around me, that's everybody's new thing. Everybody's new thing is, oh, Dave, why can't hear anything? And constantly, like, badgering me about it.
Well, it's not like we're mocking you. It's
Yes, you are.
No, we want you to get hearing aids because you need them, old man.
No, it's not even that. It's another way to bust my balls.
Oh, boo-hoo.
That's what this is.
Boo-hoo. This is
I'm
a podcast of the cinema.
And I hear just fine.
Mm-hmm.
As long as...
You have your noise-canceling headphones on.
I have on my noise-canceling headphones. Oh, yeah. As long as... There aren't seven other noises going on outside around me.
Or two.
As long as people are looking right at me and speaking.
As long as the water isn't running somewhere, you can hear just fine. Anyway, you're Dave White, film critic
for... I'm naming Henry Rollins in this lawsuit.
Film critic for linoleum-knife.com whenever you decide to start doing that again.
That's what's happening right now. It's the end of the year.
True.
I'm fixing to do my... My return to the written version of my job.
Great. And I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap and a film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick.
What color is your cord that's coming out of those headphones?
It's kind of a hot teal or something. I don't know. The aqua.
Like you got the white headphones and the... Mine's black on black.
Yes. Well, we were given a pair of black headphones and a pair of white headphones, and I let you have the black ones because they're punk rock.
White and hot teal. I might look really stylish wearing those.
Well, you decide then.
Black.
You have your way no matter what.
I wear black on the outside because black is how I feel on the inside.
So wrapping up the year, we are not going to do best and worst lists until January because that's when everything just dies on the vine. There's nothing happening. There's barely any new movies in January because...
And none worth really talking about.
Yeah, because all the sort of awards movies will be expanding wider. So in January, when things slow down a bit, that's when we'll be
doing... First week in January, we're going to do the worst.
Uh-huh.
And then the second week, we're going to do the best.
Correct. And we'll have special guests for both episodes.
Yes. So
you'll want to be here for those. In the meantime...
Did we say what this is? What show this is?
I said this is a podcast of the cinema.
Did you say who we are?
I did that too.
Where have I been?
Babbling about Henry Rollins.
That dude's loud music made me hard of hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of 1983 and 4 and 5.
You had the gun held to your head to like stand right by the speakers and not wear earplugs, genius. But we had a lovely Christmas.
We did. Got these noise-canceling headphones.
Among other things, yes.
I feel like people really gifted us with stuff this year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you and I were kind of cheap with each other, but folks really gave us presents this year.
It's true.
That was
generous people.
An unexpected, wonderful thing
that
happened. You came into our house, there were presents under the tree, and they're like, oh, you guys buy each other a lot of presents. I was like, we haven't bought each other anything.
Some stuff.
Yeah. Books.
Yeah. No. You're the big adjustment for me in being married to you at the Christmas season.
Yes.
Is the whole stocking thing.
Yeah.
Because when I was a kid, stockings were sort of there as sort of a, you know, because you had to have stockings, and my parents would just put
candy. To have stockings.
Well, you know, it's just a Christmas decorating thing, you know, and especially if you have kids, you know, the kids all have stockings.
Yeah.
And it was, of course, another one of those areas of my life where I was reminded about being the accident baby, because like all six of my sibs had matching stockings that had all been obviously purchased at the same time from the same place with the same lettering of their names.
Was yours different?
Mine was totally different.
Because your mom had your six siblings.
Mm-hmm. In an 8-year period.
And like, then boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
And then
5 years later.
And then a long period of rest.
Mm-hmm.
And then 5 years.
And just when she thought she was out of the diaper business.
Comes you.
There I showed up. Anyway, but all we got in our stockings was.
It's a bouncing baby film critic.
All we got was candy. It was like, you know, it would be like a bunch of those Hershey's miniatures and like some candy canes. And
That's fine.
That was what the stocking was.
Yeah.
And then come to find out that for you, the stocking is like
major
little treasures and gifties and things and stuff. And, you know, it's a whole curated affair.
You set about in January.
No, you set about in January.
Shh. I'm explaining the stocking.
Fine.
You begin in January and you pay attention to the person who is in your house who has a stocking that you have to fill. And that person says, oh, look at that thing. And if that thing is
small enough,
physically small, you get that thing. Or you figure out what that person is super into, and then you get gifts that correspond to that thing that they're super into, but they must be really small, and they must be able to fit into a Christmas stocking. And you do this all year long.
Mm.
You're on the hunt. You're always vigilant and aware of what's going on. And you're always looking. And you keep a list of things that your person is interested in.
I keep a list, and then I don't buy anything until, like, November.
That is a stressful way of doing things.
Well, it's not entirely my doing. Sometimes there are issues involved. The chancellor of the exchequer lets me know when Christmas shopping may commence. And then I do so.
So anyway, you want to really kick out the jams on a Christmas stocking.
Mm-hmm.
You buy that stuff all year long.
Well, and I'd say even given the way I do it, you've got a pretty great stocking.
Yeah, you do. Here's what you do, though. You wind up.
I have no mental,
no spatial
perception of what fits in that stocking. Like, so there's always you always get a spillover stocking.
You think a Christmas stocking is Snoopy's doghouse?
Yeah, the TARDIS. Like, it's bigger on the inside.
Yeah, it's the size of a Christmas stocking, but inside it's the size of a giant box that I will fill with as many things as possible. And so what ends up happening is that the spare Christmas stocking that is just decorative winds up being employed because you're like, oh, I bought nine of these Ritter Sport candy bars that I know he likes. That'll fill up a stocking all by itself.
It's a learning process.
I'll tell you the best thing. The best thing in my stocking.
What was that?
With those little travel Maldon sea salts. I've been wanting some of those for so long. They seem ridiculous to purchase on my own. I don't want to walk into, you know, the gourmet shop and be like, I'll take one of these little travel salts that I can carry my sea salt around with me everywhere I go.
So you made me go buy them for
you. Yes, but if they're given to you, you're like, aha, little travel sea salts. Now I can have sea salt with me everywhere I go. When places don't put proper salt on the food, I can sprinkle a little sea salt on it now.
You are so precious.
I just know how I like my things to taste. And I want them to taste like that Maldon sea salt.
Well,
that's what I want.
That was one of the many awesome things I put in your sock monster.
That was the best thing. That $2 thing. That was the best thing. So we have these movies we're going to talk about.
Yeah, yes. Why not?
Now that we're done praising each other for Christmas gifts.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't know if it's the Star Wars effect, but I kind of, this week sort of feels like a lot of afterthoughts. Or maybe they were just movies that seemed like they would be better before we saw them, and then you see them and you're like,
There's one that is is that you really love, though.
True.
And then I feel the same way about.
Yes.
Why don't you begin with that one?
Well, it's in very small release, so it's quite likely
how
not
many screens?
Near yet. I don't know, but it's pretty limited. Now, of course, if you live in England, this played already last summer, and you're like rolling your eyes.
Oh, did it really?
Now getting it? Yes.
It opened there already.
Yes.
In the summertime.
Yeah, because it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival. It's a movie called 45 Years. Or no, sorry, premiered at Berlin actually, where it won the Best Actor and Best Actress prizes. Hmm. 45 Years, it is the newest film from Andrew Haig, who wrote and directed Weekend, which was my favorite film of 2011. He also directed quite a few episodes of HBO's Looking. And from those two things, you know, he sort of has this reputation of like, oh, guy who's really smart about telling gay love stories. Turns out, nope, just smart about telling love stories, period. Smart about characters and dialogue and subtlety. This is about a married couple played by British film legends Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay, and they are about to celebrate their 45th anniversary because when their 40th
just
came
like
up,
us
when they came up with their on their 40th, he was in the hospital, so they decided to wait and do a big blowout for 45.
Oh yeah, it opened on Wednesday on 3 screens nationwide.
Yeah,
so one of them is here,
probably.
One of them's in New York, and the other is
maybe San Francisco. I don't
probably.
Know. Yeah. So, you know, they're getting ready for this big event, and it's all about, you know, they're celebrating their lengthy marriage, and then a bomb drops. He receives a letter informing him that his previous girlfriend, who he had been involved with before Charlotte Rampling, her body has been found frozen in a glacier in the mountains in Switzerland where they had spent time and traveled. And
that is a demise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as he is sort of dealing with that and his feelings about that, the wife comes to realize how much this other woman has impacted their life together and the decisions that they made and, you know, just all how much of a presence she's been in the marriage without the wife ever realizing it. And suddenly it all coming to a head and understanding, you know, how much he's been carrying around the ghost of this other woman for the entire time they've been together. And it is very subdued.
Yes.
This is not a movie that explains a lot of things to you, that gives you a lot of sort of exposition dumps. Charlotte Rampling is giving this amazing performance that is so much about glances and pauses and intakes of breath and things.
It reminds me in that way a lot of Carol.
Sure, yeah.
In that what's not being said, and this is even more so than Carol, because Carol does come right out and tell you the things it needs to tell you.
Yeah. Carol, they're dealing with a sort of, you know, 50s propriety, and here it's just a longtime couple who have all these things
they don't talk about to each other because they already know each other. So.
Yeah. And also there's, you know, obviously this is it turns out to be this facet of their relationship that they've never really talked much about.
Right.
And they don't really know how to start.
Yeah. It's beautifully intimate and very quiet and, the kind of film that must be given your full attention. This
no
is not a. It's not really a film to watch on TV.
Yeah,
I mean, most people will because it's an art house film, and art houses don't exist everywhere. And even when they do, they don't get everything.
Yeah.
So
Sundance Selects is putting it out, so I assume it will be on demand at some point.
When eventually it does make itself available streaming or on DVD, you know. Give yourself the pleasure of a quiet, private screening for you so that you're not distracted by phones and by people in your home and stuff like that. The performances are beautiful. It looks beautiful. I love... Is he using the same cinematographer as Weekend in this one?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I don't remember.
You know, it looks good, just like Weekend looked. It has that nice naturalistic sort of feel to it, and
more pastoral than urban in this case.
Well, yeah.
I love this movie a lot. It was a very close runner up to my top 10.
You had to get Grandma in there.
Yeah, I did have to get Grandma in there. Because it's a great movie.
It's fine. Grandma's fine.
I could not be less interested in what you think about my top 10 list.
No, you bounce your top 10 list right off of me because you know that I'm...
And I changed nothing based on your feedback. Perhaps you noticed. Anyway, yes.
Well, you should have.
So, yeah, 45 years. Seek it out. It is great. And, you know, and I have been a fan of Andrew Hakes for a long time, and I am excited by the idea that he will now get to be, he can make any kind of movie that he wants, and at least in terms of, if he wants to make more gay movies, great, and if he wants to, are your headphones aren't even on, by the way.
Yeah, they are.
And is the light on? Did you click the switch over? Now they're on.
Well, they've been on the whole time.
No.
But no, they've been on, but they haven't been, the noise canceling part hasn't been on.
Okay. All right.
But I've been hearing everything.
Okay.
You and me. And,
gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. No, I would have noticed that.
I would say the little light wasn't
on. I'm not that inept.
Aren't you?
No. Maybe. I am that inept. Factually speaking.
This is another scene from 20 years.
Yeah. The sequel, I guess the prequel, is Us. It's a film called 20 Years. Where...
Quit being stupid.
There are no ghosts from the past haunting us. There are just stupidities of the present.
Yes. And which, believe me, he says to me as much as I say to him.
He did not use the same cinematographer.
Is it Lal Crawley?
Lal Crawley. Yeah. He was the DP for Ballast, if you remember that.
Yes, yes, yes.
And
yes.
How good looking that movie is.
Yeah. And a couple other really cool movies. I remember looking at
Four Lions.
Yes.
And a bunch of other stuff.
So yeah, by all means, one to look for, and then of course the in wider release,
Daddy's Home.
Oh, Daddy's Home! God, I forgot about
which
that.
I refuse to go see. I just am not doing it.
Lucky you!
There was a press screening at what was it like 10 a.m.
on Saturday morning
before Christmas. And yeah. I just said I'm not going. I don't need to see this. I don't care if it's Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg and how much fun The Other Guys was, mm-hmm. and how hilarious that film was.
Yeah.
Just because it's those two guys doesn't mean it's going to be the same kind of movie, and I could smell it from the trailer.
Yeah, you are correct. Because, yeah, I loved The Other Guys, and I thought that was a really smart movie and funny and unexpected. And this...
So why don't you tell everyone about it so that I don't have to, because doggy. I'm never going to watch this
yes.
film.
This is a very PG-13 movie, because it wants to be... naughty, R-rated, let's make jokes about,
Sexy things. Yeah.
And at the same time, oh, adorable children and kids movie. And it does not really work on either level.
Adorable children ruin almost everything.
Yeah. So the premise is that Will Ferrell, dork, you know, works for like a light jazz radio station.
Yeah.
Wants to be a dad, but, you know... a dental technician zapped him in the badoobies with an x-ray machine.
Yes.
As Tootsie would say. And so, he is infertile, but he winds up marrying Linda Cardellini, who has two kids from a previous marriage. And they, you know, perceive him as an interloper, but you see slowly over time, he begins to finally kind of like become part of the family, and they think of him as, you know, a father figure and da da da. And just at that moment when he's finally, you know, cracked the code and getting in with these kids,
right,
the bio dad shows up.
Yeah.
Played by Mark Wahlberg, who's some sort of international man of mystery. Like, it's never quite clear what he does, but it seems to involve like gun running and things. And so then, of course, the battle is on, you know, for the affection of the children. And of course, Mark Wahlberg is playing all these head games on Will Ferrell. And
right.
Then finally, Will Ferrell decides to try and play some back and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, as premises go, it's not terrible. You could make an okay movie out of all this.
Right.
But maybe don't hire the people who made We're the Millers and Mr. Popper's Penguins and I forget what other crap
movies. You know, I like those penguins.
Yeah, well.
Those penguins did a lot of funny things.
This movie's just... And the thing is, it's not completely laugh-free. Oh, yeah. It's from the director of That's My Boy. Which a movie only you defend.
You know, I like That's My Boy.
there are a handful of sort of funny physical comedy moments, but for the most part, this is a chore. and just annoying. And it's a big waste of time. And speaking of big waste of time, I also had to go see Point Break. Because they canceled all of the press screenings.
I still...
The one press screening, anyway.
I still want to... I actually kind of still want to see Point Break.
Ugh, seriously, spare yourself.
Here was the scenario. They set up a press screening.
For the 23rd of December.
December 23rd.
Ho, ho, ho.
And you're like, oh, good. You must have so much confidence in this film. December 23rd. And they did this intentionally so that no one would come.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everybody is mentally checked out by that point and you know, they're traveling or whatever.
And then after they set it up,
they cancel it. And they say due to unforeseen circumstances,
the translation of which means we showed it to someone that mattered enough that hated it, and now we don't want anyone to see it.
Or we showed it to somebody who was such a pushover, and even they hated it.
Right.
Something like that happened, because...
This
movie opened weeks
ago. Guaranteed, that's the way it went down.
The movie opened weeks ago in Asia, so it's not like it wasn't finished yet,
right?
They were still color correcting. It's like, no, yeah. Movie's done.
Right.
Movie is in the can, on screens in Hong Kong as we speak.
Yes.
You know? The other trades already like sent their Singapore stringer or whoever to go review this thing.
Yes.
Thankfully, I have compassionate bosses at the Wrap
who are like,
I said, you don't
have to go on Christmas.
I said, look, if you guys need a review on Christmas, I will go on Christmas. I will see Point Break and I will write a review. If it's all the same,
you're a team player.
I'm a team player.
Yeah.
I said, if it's all the same to you, I'll go to the first show on Saturday the 26th. And they were like, that's completely fine. So thank you, The Wrap, for that, for not completely destroying my Christmas.
So the day after Christmas, you and I went our separate ways.
Yes, you went to go see The Hateful Eight.
At 8:30 in the morning at the Arclight.
In a packed house.
Sold out screening at 8:30 in the morning, which was a little annoying to me, but at least even it was like 98% sold out, there was a seat open next to me, so I still had
right.
some.
Well, there's a limited number of 70mm shows, so they're going to pile into whatever one they can get into.
Yeah,
we'll get to that one in a second. So anyway, so I go see Point Break on Saturday morning by myself.
Here's what I want to know.
I'm not even that big a fan of the first one.
Is it? What's that noise?
Car, plane.
It's a car outside. Yeah. Okay, so here's what I want to know.
What's that?
Are the extreme sports stunts worth going to see it, like at a cheapy matinee?
Because
the trailer has a few shots of that kind of stuff, and it made me feel like, ooh, Mountain Dew.
It is very Mountain Dew. There are a couple that are pretty cool. There's a scene where they like jump off a mountaintop with those like flying squirrel outfits, like Jaden Smith wears in After Earth.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, you know, and they're like zipping all around and going through these valleys. And, you know, what I started noticing was that anytime there was a stunt where you didn't see the actors' faces, it was great because you were just stuntmen wearing like helmets and goggles. But then when you had to incorporate the actors into stuff, it didn't look so good. Although, except at the end, there's a rock climbing thing where you see the faces of the actors and it's still pretty good. The stunts themselves are impressive, and the stunt team certainly deserves all praise their way.
Yeah.
The director is a terrible director, but he's a good cinematographer.
Okay.
He shoots it all very well. But he has no idea how to incorporate those stunts into the plot of the movie, and neither does the guy who wrote this thing.
Okay.
Who also wrote the remakes of Total Recall and The Thomas Crown Affair, which was not terrible.
Eh.
But, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So this time, Johnny Utah... is an extreme sports dude, and he's got like a, you know, he's got a sports drink sponsor, and he and his best bro do this motocross thing that involves going through this very complicated like series of little hills or whatever, and it ends with them jumping. You know, like in those movies that are set in Monument Valley, there's those like pillars that are kind of standing in the middle of nothing.
Yes.
In the desert, they like jump from the edge of a cliff onto one of those pillars and spin around, and you know, ta-da!
Right.
So Johnny Utah does that, and the guy behind him spins out a little too far and goes over the edge and dies.
Boom.
So Johnny Utah, I'll never extreme sports again. He decides to. He gets his GED, he goes to college, he goes to law school. We cut to 7 years later where he's now at the FBI Academy. Sure. And
but then he's going to go undercover.
Well, and then at first they just need him as a consultant because someone is doing extreme sports crimes.
Right.
And they need his expertise on all this.
I have to go see this.
Oh, gosh. And I'm already thinking, wait, how are you going to go undercover when you're, like, famous and you left your sport to go to FBI school?
It's like, hi, everybody, I'm Sean White, and I'm here to infiltrate your gang.
Yeah, like ESPN wouldn't have already done a documentary about this guy, about his tragic loss and how that, you know, made him go to law school.
I think I got to go see this.
Anyway, it's stupid, this movie. I felt really bad. Well, I didn't feel bad because they got to go to Italy and France and collect a nice paycheck.
Well, yeah.
Delroy Lindo and Ray Winstone have just like are trying to be like FBI plot guys, you know. And
so, okay, while you're doing that,
mm-hmm.
You know, I love Christmas because, I mean, it's Christmas, but the movie theaters in Los Angeles, they begin. Their daily matinees at like 7 o'clock in the morning.
Earlier, if you're going to Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, Star Wars is still going around the clock, I think.
Yeah.
But because the theater is open mm-hmm. for Star Wars, they're like, okay, we're just going to show Hateful Eight at 8:30 in the morning.
Right.
We're going to show Joy at 7:30 in the morning. Like, it doesn't matter. No one cares. And there might be five people in those other, you know.
Yeah. They've already turned the lights on. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah, I want to go. I want to know who's going to see things like The Danish Girl at like 8 a.m. Like, who's doing that? But the people like me who get up early, who are early risers, who have most of their attention and their energy in the mornings, mm-hmm. You know, we appreciate this. And so I'm thinking, oh, good, I'll go see Hateful Eight at 8:30 in the morning on the day after Christmas. 4 days before Christmas, I bought my ticket, and there were like five other people in the house. There's a big house at the ArcLight.
Yeah, this is one of the houses where they show 70mm.
Yeah.
Not in the dome this year because Star Wars trumped it, and Quentin's so mad about it.
He is quite angry about this.
Yeah,
but the
five days before,
then I got there,
packed.
Packed. It's like, who are you jerks?
Get out of my theater.
Muscling in on me having a nice little quiet morning movie with myself. Like I said, about 98% sold out, and there was still an empty seat next to me. So I can't fully complain. At least no strangers were touching me. You know, I don't like that.
Because, like, you know, if somebody sits next to you in a movie theater, they're just like, touch.
They're just all touchy on me. I'm fighting for the seat.
The armrest.
Yeah,
that's true.
And, but the good thing is, generally, I win the armrest war.
Yeah, people are easily cowed in that department.
I'm kind of an ox, and so it doesn't matter. Like, you know. So I saw Hateful Eight. Well, first I'll tell you what happened. So you got Sam Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a bounty hunter.
Right.
And he, hang on. I'm opening up my
program book.
My special
souvenir.
My souvenir program book from the special roadshow engagement.
Yes. In Ultra Panavision 70.
Currently, it was shot in Ultra Panavision 70, which has not been used since 1966.
Yeah.
Since Khartoum.
Yeah.
with the shot. It's a mad, 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 mad world in that. And it is a long dormant
format.
But it makes for an aspect ratio of craziness.
Yeah,
of
like 3-1 or something.
Super long. It's like 2.76:1. It's like that narrow envelope. Like when they show it on, when they show those old movies on TCM like that, it's like you just get a rectangle on your screen.
It's not letterbox, it's mail slot.
So. Yeah. And so currently it's playing in about 100 theaters nationwide or 100 screens nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
That can accommodate 70 millimeter film, actual film, 70 right. millimeter film. And this, you know, super long envelope kind of screen shape. You get a special program book. You get an overture.
Mm-hmm.
You get
of the score by Ennio Morricone.
An intermission. And it's kind of a nice, I tell you, it is a nice way to go to the movies. To get that in. That intermission is such a good, you know.
Yeah.
It is a thing that I miss from the olden times of going to movies.
I think Reds is the last movie I saw that had an intermission in it.
Yeah.
No one does it anymore.
So, okay. So, Sam Jackson, he's a bounty hunter. He meets up with Kurt Russell.
Sam Jackson, who is hauling three corpses.
Yeah, hauling three corpses. Kurt Russell is a hangman.
No.
Well, he's called the hangman, but he's also a bounty hunter, but who
he always gets his prey alive.
He brings his bounty to the hangman.
Yes.
So that the hangman can, you know,
do his job.
He's got Jennifer Jason Leigh, who is the prisoner. And she has been accused of murder. We don't know why or how or really anything about her.
But there's quite a price on her head.
Until the near end of the film do we understand who she is and what she is, who she's connected to and what she has done.
Right.
On their way, when they get to their destination, which is not their destination, they're going to Red Rock. And
you're already telling this wrong.
I'm not telling it wrong.
You are. Kurt Russell is in a stagecoach with Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Right.
They allow Sam, after much discussion, because it's a Tarantino movie and they have to talk about everything for a long time. After much discussion, they let Sam Jackson in and his corpse is on the roof.
Then, again,
they stop again where they encounter Walton Goggins.
Yes.
Before they get to any destination.
Yes, yes, yes.
Who is also on his way to Red Rock. He claims to be the new sheriff. After another protracted discussion, he is also allowed into the stagecoach. Meanwhile, a winter storm is brewing.
It's a blizzard.
They find themselves stopping at a roadhouse known as Minnie's Haberdashery. Proceed.
Now I may continue?
Yes.
Thanks for all the help.
You were being wrong, and I had to fix it.
Inside Minnie's Haberdashery is Michael Madsen as a man named Joe Gage, which I thought was really funny.
I would love to know if Quentin Tarantino deliberately named this character after the legendary director of gay pornography. I'm guessing yes.
I assume when anything happens in a Quentin Tarantino movie, I think that it's intentional.
Sure.
And that if it is referencing anything historical,
yeah.
I think that he did that intentionally too.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say that this is real.
Yeah.
This is because of that.
I don't know if anybody's asked him that in an interview, but that would be my first question.
They run into Tim Roth,
mm-hmm. Oswaldo Mowbray.
Yeah. Bruce Dern, and then they've also got
Damien Bashir
as a guy named Bob, but they all call him the Mexican because he is the one Mexican cast member. And they've got him. I was discussing this with Gary yesterday. Damien Bashir, his face is nearly completely obscured by a beard and a giant hat and every other thing, because you can't have Damien Bashir in a movie without his stunning handsomeness pulling focus
from the rest of the movie.
From the rest of the movie. So if you want him to just be like a regular character actor looking guy, you've got to cover him up as much as possible.
You have to hide his light under a bushel.
Otherwise, you're like, who let the male model in here? He's a handsome dude.
He is.
And so, I think I've said this before, when I saw him in A Better Life, I think it's called, when he was nominated for an Oscar for. He's down on his down and out, sort of, you know, immigrant guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why don't you just go be a model somewhere? It's like watching Baby Boy.
I was going to say.
Same thing.
What's his face?
Watching Baby Boy, and there was like, you better get a job, Baby Boy. And I'm like, why don't you go be an Abercrombie & Fitch model?
Tyson Beckford.
Because that's, no, it's Fast and Furious.
Tyrese Gibson.
Tyrese.
I knew it was Ty something.
Not Tyson, Tyrese.
Yes, Ty Baby, you know.
Any movie where someone is completely down and out, but they're extremely good looking, you're like, just go be a model.
Duh.
You could totally just go be a model.
So the Hateful Eight.
So then they're in the place.
Yes.
For the entire first two-thirds of the film. They are.
Until the intermission.
Inside. So this is a Western.
And it's shot in 70mm. So you're thinking, oh, well, okay.
Expensive Western.
It's going to be big sky country and like cattle roaring across the screen. And then they get to this cabin. And they're in the cabin. And we got to the intermission. I saw this a few weeks ago. And I said out loud, what if they just stay in the cabin? What if this turns out to be a chamber piece, locked room mystery, Agatha Christie style? Which reminded me of seeing Locke and thinking,
What if we never get out of the car?
What if he stays in the car?
Yeah.
What if the whole movie is him in the car?
Right.
And indeed, after intermission, they're still in the cabin.
I really, really love Quentin Tarantino for doing this.
And then when you wonder, wait, where does Zoe Bell and all the other people in the credits come into all this?
After the intermission.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about what happens after the intermission.
All right, fine.
I really don't, because you get a hint as you're watching the first chunk, pre-intermission chunk, that the lure of Ultra Panavision 70 has been a bit of a bait and switch.
Yeah.
Not entirely, because it looks gorgeous. I mean, sure. Like, and by gorgeous, I mean it's beautifully shot and really beautifully
detailed.
Production design is really, really incredible. But it's grimy and dirty and gross and ugly and violent and people getting their heads, you know, destroyed and stuff like that. So you, and when you finally get to that stuff, you've spent a full film's worth of time of people in a room talking.
Snowed in.
And talking and talking and talking and talking.
It's kind of like Eight Women.
Without
the musical numbers.
So then all the rest of the people that are listed in the cast, Zoe Bell, Lee Horsley.
Matt Houston.
Yeah. Channing Tatum. They're later. They're after the intermission.
Yeah.
And what they bring is what you would normally consider to be all of the plot catalysts, which happen in the final hour of this 3-hour film. But that's really not why this movie is so strange. It is strange because everything that you've known Quentin Tarantino to do formally is here, but it's also being upended in funny, you know, sort of ridiculous ways. And I don't want to wreck that stuff for the audience. But I found myself watching this and sort of smiling a lot to myself, thinking, "Oh, I see what you did there."
Yeah.
And that is a really, for me, I love when the filmmaker is aiming up and not down.
Well, I know people, for instance, who've said, you know, ugh, Reservoir Dogs. Like, I wish they would stop talking about Madonna and just go, you know, rob a bank or whatever. And this movie is all the talking about Madonna parts.
Yes.
This movie is the you know, diner scenes from Death Proof. This movie is a talky-talky-talking movie.
Right.
With violence thrown in, obviously, but, you know.
Extreme violence.
Yes.
By the way. And
Here's my thing with this. Ultimately, I was entertained by it, and I was enjoying it while I was watching it, and I left thinking like, okay, that was, I like what he did there. I see what he was going for. Blah, blah. And then I read what people don't like about it, either formally or in terms of its content, like the way that, you know, the N-word is thrown around, the way that the, yeah, you know, the Jennifer Jason Leigh character is handled. And I think, well, yeah, I mean, I can't argue anything, and it's not a movie that I can't defend it against those charges. But nonetheless, I did find myself entertained by the film.
Here's if I have, I do have reservations about this film, and it has nothing to do with the violence, which we have seen in his earlier films, and it has nothing to do with that racist word, because that has also been part of his filmmaking for years.
Right.
For film after film after film.
Somebody referred to Sam Jackson as his get out of jail free card.
I don't think it's a get out of jail free card. I we're going to get sidetracked here on this for a minute, but it's not really where I want to go. But I think that when you have a word that the world around you is so terrified of, unless it is in the context of an actual horrible racist pig saying it with impunity and without thought, when you have that word, I think it's worth exploring that word. And I think that Tarantino employs that word in a really weaponized way. And he isn't doing it to shock. He isn't doing it for empty shock.
Yeah.
He isn't doing it for, you know, some sort of like nose-thumbing activity.
I think in this film and in Django, it's communicating something very specific about the era in which the film is set.
That is true. I think in Django, which I think works much better than this film, I think it's used as a really sharp sort of poking stick to the audience. I think that this film suffers not for the use of that word, but for not seeming to have much to say. I feel like Death Proof, Kill Bill, Django, Inglourious Bastards, all revenge films. And all about oppressed people taking their turn.
Women, Jews, black people.
Yeah.
Other women.
Yeah. I don't know, other than an exercise in, you know, what's the mystery? Who's the bad guy? It's kind of like Clue.
I said that in my review that it was like Clue. Yeah. And of course some snotty know-it-all in the comments like, no, it's like the Petrified Forest.
Okay,
like,
sure.
Yeah, it's like, well, you're not wrong, but neither am I. Shut up.
Right. Yeah, it is also like the Petrified Forest, and that is because, and anyone who's watched a Quentin Tarantino film knows this, if you know anything about films that came earlier, in the art world, there is art about art and painting about painting and all of that. And
certainly movies about movies.
And Tarantino makes a very unique type of film about film. Mm. The people who are influenced by him don't do it exactly the way he does it. Godard is the biggest influence on Tarantino because Godard made films about film.
Todd Alcott, screenwriter who I know, who's a Facebook friend of mine, and writes really fascinating blog entries about how scripts work. Like, he's been doing a character analysis on the Star Wars Force Awakens characters that, if you're interested, you should go check out.
Right.
But when I posted my review of Hateful Eight on Facebook, and I talked about how the movie's how it felt like an art prank, the whole 70 millimeter thing. He said all of his films are art pranks. And for all of his talk about blaxploitation and kung fu and whatever, it's Godard that Tarantino really goes back to the well.
Oh, he said that.
Time. Yeah.
Well, we're both right. So I feel like those revenge films had something to say to me and to you know, the viewing audience about the United States and you know, our history and our politics and the way
Western civilization,
the way we treat each other and the kinds of films we've made and how those films have reflected our history. And how his films sort of now are sort of like a bit of revisionist history in a way. You know, what if these awful people in history got their comeuppance?
Right.
In real time, you know.
I'd love to see Tarantino and Greg Araki collaborate on something, since they both love
Godard,
and they're both, you know, I'd love to see like Tarantino's idea tempered through Araki's idea of like a queer revenge picture.
Yeah. But so, as much as entertained as I am by this, and you know how much I love extreme violence in film, and as entertained as I was by this, I don't know that I have the burning desire to see it again, because I don't feel like there's much left to see after having seen it once.
Once its mysteries are unlocked.
Yeah. Performance-wise, oh, how I love that Jennifer Jason Leigh. Stealing every moment. Someone else is doing the talking, and over in the corner, she's pulling some kind of face. Letting you know that she has secrets. I won't tell you what they are, but she's giving you these sort of visual face clues the whole time, and she has not one F left to give and is really going for it throughout the entire film.
I think my favorite performance is actually Walton Goggins.
And he's fantastic, too.
Yeah. And I think also somebody was saying he's the only character who has an arc. I've seen him in a few movies. I never watched like Justified, which I know is his main claim to fame. Yeah. But he's really quite good in this.
So, you know, if I would say this is the worst Tarantino film I've ever seen, you know, that's not exactly the same thing as saying that I didn't like it.
It's the least good.
It's the one that I probably wouldn't go back and watch again,
right.
Other than for its good looks.
Uh-huh.
I feel like the other movies have more to say, all the way back even to Reservoir Dogs.
All right.
And but you know, I still really enjoyed myself. I still think it's excellent.
Hmm.
You dig what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you.
Then there was Concussion.
Hey.
You guys, don't play football.
It's bad.
You're going to get hit in the head, and then you'll get a concussion.
And then you'll be...
Will Smith's going to tear the lid off it, though.
Yes. This.
They made a documentary about this already. You might want to go see
like
that
on Frontline.
Yeah, what was it called?
I forget.
Hang on, let me.
Yeah, and apparently, the more you know about the actual story, the more bogus this movie becomes. Like, I mean, when we were reading on What the Flick, Ben was really digging into it. The movie is about Will Smith as this Nigerian doctor who works in the coroner's office in I think it's Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. And starts doing, there are these incidents of former pro football players who kill themselves, or they have some sort of mental illness. And in the process of doing these autopsies, he starts...
League of Denial was on PBS.
He starts realizing that there's a stuff that's happening in their brains, and their brain chemistry is affected, and that it probably has something to do with all the times that your head gets banged around in football. And according to Ben, apparently a lot of researchers figured this out, and sequences in the film are told out of order for dramatic kind of da, da, da. And fine, that's annoying enough, but I'm willing to sort of, you know, cut a movie some slack when you're doing a docudrama. That's what you do for the drama part.
No, that's fine.
And that's in and of itself, that's not a bad thing, but you still have to make a drama, and this is not a very good drama.
No.
It feels so generically like little guy fighting against the system.
One man must rise.
Yeah, on What the Flick, I said it was basically a Mad Lib, you know, where you add your own David and Goliath. You know, in this case, it's this doctor, and it's, you know, the NFL. And Smith is fine. He's doing an accent, and he's acting up a storm, but he's not terrible. He's, you know, you lose him in it after a
while. Who got the Academy Award the year he was nominated for Ali?
I don't remember. That wasn't the Roberto Benigni year, I hope. But who knows? It might have been. And Gugu Mbatha-Raw plays his wife, and she's awesome.
She's always great.
Yeah. You know, she doesn't get quite enough to do, but she has some moments. You know, it gets into sort of Aaron Brockovich, you know, Silkwood territory, where they feel like the NFL is following them everywhere and maybe trying to kill them or something. And it just doesn't really add up to much. It's directed by the guy who made Parkland. Did you ever see that one? About the day that Kennedy was shot.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah, and neither is this. It's just whatever, concussion, you know. David Morse, as a former Pittsburgh Steelers player, I don't know what they did to his head. His head looks larger. There were times I thought I was watching Michael Fassbender in Frank, you know, with the big papier-mâché head. Because his head is just... it's crazy. I don't know how they made up his face and his head to look that way. But yeah, it's just nothing very exceptional. You could see this as a sort of earnest TV movie, except that no TV network would air it because they all show football, you know.
Right.
Albert Brooks and Alec Baldwin are fine, giving exactly the kind of performance you'd expect Alec Baldwin and Albert Brooks to give in this kind of movie.
Right.
It's just nothing special.
Denzel Washington won for Training Day that year.
Oh.
Because they forgot to give it to him for Malcolm X.
Right.
And so that means Will Smith, who should have gotten it for Ali, didn't get his. And so now he'll get nominated for something
else
less good than
Ali. Probably
not
this one, but who knows.
And probably not this. His time will come.
Sure, of course.
Because Will Smith is a competent actor. Sure. And in the right role can be really great.
Mm-hmm.
Not this.
Yeah, I mean, he's not bad.
You can see him working. Like, you can see him working at acting.
Yes.
And that is always the distraction for me. If I'm watching you work.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't feel like I was watching him work in Ali. I felt like he was just doing it.
I think after a while, and once I got used to the fact that that voice was coming out of that face, It felt less like I was just watching him do a thing. But I think if the material were stronger, we'd be more excited about the performance.
But this is utterly unremarkable.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like it's kind of a duck. You know, it's like, oh, guess what, everybody?
Banging your head into a bunch of other people's heads.
We have learned.
Is bad for you.
We have learned that if someone takes a skull-crushing, you know, activity and does it a lot...
Mm-hmm.
Their skull will be crushed.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. I think we're seeing, you know, like a new generation of moms who are like, you are not playing football.
Right. Yeah. High school kids die.
Yeah.
Playing football.
Yeah.
They don't die on a swim team.
And obviously the NFL is not, you know,
excited. That's what you did. You were a swim team guy.
I was on the swim team. I wasn't very good, but I was on it.
You were like a gazelle of swimming.
Because gazelles don't know how to swim.
I don't know. Maybe they do.
No, I got a rock. Anyway.
You're like, what else can I do instead of swim team? Ooh, debate.
I'll take it. Anyway, moving on.
Joy, which I have not seen yet.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm getting caught up on that, though, right away.
All
right. Because, like, I'm probably going tomorrow morning.
Okay. Well, when we can talk, we can revisit this one.
You say your thing, and then we'll talk about it again when I have the right opinion.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. We're also going to talk about The Revenant next time because Dave hasn't seen it yet, and it opened on a very few screens.
I was doing a lot of baking. That's my excuse.
I'm not accusing you of anything.
I was doing a lot of baking. I made the cranberry.
Oh, that cranberry bread.
The cranberry bread.
So good.
From the great
Holiday Bake Off.
Holiday Baking Show.
We'll talk about that on LKTV. But yeah, you actually got that recipe and ran with it, and it was real tasty.
It was...
You did not make a candy cane shape
the no, way that
the judges
screw that.
Asked. But,
Mary, listen, Mary Berry comes to this house,
mm-hmm.
I'll try to shape it into a candy cane for her.
Fair enough.
Otherwise,
Life's too short.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about The Revenant next time. But in the meantime, yeah, Joy. God, such a letdown. Because I loved Silver Linings Playbook. I loved American Hustle. I love I Heart Huckabees. I'm a David O. Russell fan.
Me too.
I like his stuff
a lot.
Me
too.
This movie is a mess. It just feels like it keeps changing what kind of movie it's going to be and what it's going to be about.
What is it about?
It's about this woman named Joy Mangano, whose last name is never mentioned in the film. Like, I didn't know until it was over that she was a real person.
Oh, I see.
Or at least maybe at some point in the
movie. You thought her first and last names were both Joy?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Joy Joy.
Joy Joy. No, it never comes up. She's
right.
Just Joy.
Yeah.
She...
Just Joy.
Just Joy. She is... The real Joy Mangano is this entrepreneur and inventor. She created the Miracle Mop. You know, she was the person who figured out that you could have the mop with the plastic thing that would come down and squeeze out
right.
the head so you don't yes. have to touch it.
Yeah.
She invented like some these thin hangers, like all these different things, and was a real pioneer in selling this stuff on QVC.
Right.
So as the movie begins, you know, she is as a young girl, very creative and, you know, always kind of devising things. And, you know, early on, she apparently created some kind of dog collar that, you know, would snap away so dogs wouldn't choke on it or whatever.
Right.
And then she never patented it. And then somebody else invented it and Hartz put it out and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
She gets married. She has kids. Her parents get divorced and her mother's, you know, like never leaves the TV room. And,
okay.
And so she's sort of the one sane person kind of keeping everything afloat. She doesn't take care of all these needy people. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's kind of crushed her childhood dreams. She hasn't really been creative. She hasn't, you know, been able to do stuff.
All right.
And then she has this moment where she comes up with this mop and it sort of revives her, her youthful creativity. And I thought, okay, this is an interesting movie. This is an interesting story. And then suddenly it's a story about the early days of QVC. And you got Bradley Cooper who... acts as though he's Sam Goldwyn or something. Like, he's one of the moguls of yours. He keeps sort of quoting, like, David Selznick and people like that and how, you know, he's kind of creating this whole new genre of home shopping.
Okay.
And that's interesting. It's a different movie from the other one, but okay, sure, fine. Then, after all this time setting up the Bradley Cooper character, he leaves the film until the end. He's gone.
Right.
And then suddenly it's about this sort of internal thing about, like, you know, her family who's supposed to be helping out with a company, like screwing her over or not making the right deals and blah, blah, blah. And then it seems like she's going to lose everything and she hits rock bottom and she has this like tearful speech to her own daughter that's like, oh, you know, it's the equivalent of the dreams die speech in Xanadu, you know,
okay.
like just, you know, don't bother, the world's just going to crush you, blah, blah, like just awful, awful, like, you know, you can't believe a mother is saying this to her daughter.
Yes.
Then she cuts her own hair, and then, bam, she fixes everything.
Well, she's Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, well, and that's part of the problem. Jennifer Lawrence is a terrific actress, but she's too young to play this woman who has been beaten down by life. And people say, oh, but the real Joy, you know, when you see her on QVC, like, she was very youthful and blah, blah, blah.
Wasn't this supposed to be a movie for Kristen Wiig anyway?
Well, Annie Mumolo, who co-wrote Bridesmaids with Kristen Wiig, has a co-story credit.
Okay.
David O. Russell has the sole screenplay credit, but she gets a story by credit.
I see.
So I'm sure at some point she, you know, perceived it as a whole other thing. And apparently Wendy McClendon Covey, who was in Bridesmaids and is now on the Goldbergs, apparently did quite a few tweets earlier this year basically saying that, like, forget what you hear about David O. Russell, this is Annie's script, you know, start to finish or something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, there's some stuff going on in the background. I also heard, and this is pure, you know, just gossipy whatever.
Oh, you should say it then out loud.
Of course, yes. What I heard was that David O. Russell, who was frantically finishing this thing, like, right before people saw it.
Yeah.
And apparently that's kind of his MO. Like, all of his movies are sort of last minute. He's still changing and whatever.
Yeah.
He was actually wanting to wait until next year to put it out. And apparently, his producer, Megan Ellison, wanted it out in this year's awards and sort of, like, leaned on him to finish it earlier.
But you don't know if any of that's
true. I don't know
if
any of that is true. But, you know, never let the truth stand in the way of a good story. It seems like the kind of movie that was not finished in a way that allowed them to really kind of find the voice of it. And the thing about it, this movie made me retroactively appreciate Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle all the more.
Right.
Because those are movies that really could, I mean, assuming you didn't already hate them, but if you're a fan of those movies like I was, they were very close to not working in many moments. Like, it's a high wire act. The stuff that he's doing, the way he's telling the story, the kind of dialogue he puts in his characters' mouths, it could all collapse. And it doesn't in those two cases. And in this one, it does. But it has its fans. There are people who love this movie. You know,
I'm such a huge fan of hers. I think she's so terrific that
She's not terrible. I think she's miscast.
I'm leaning toward automatically liking her just because of her.
Well, see what you think. But, I mean, she was too young for the part in American Hustle, but she acted it in a way that you bought it, and it didn't bother you that she was probably about 10 years younger than the character she was playing. This one, I felt like the character's done more living than is visible in that young dewy face,
right? You know? Yes,
but that's not even the main problem. The main problem, I think, is just that it's all over the place and that the story keeps switching gears. You know, Elizabeth Rome from American Hustle plays her sister or her half sister, and she basically wanders in and has the same scene like five times. Like, she says the same stuff, acts the same way, and then leaves. And then she comes back and does it again later. I was really let down by Joy.
So we're done.
That's everything?
Now it's time to talk about the DVD recommendations.
Okay. Well, my DVD recommendation, I wanted to pay tribute to the great Haskell Wexler, one of the essential sort of post-World War II cinematographers in this country. He shot Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Conversation and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and In the Heat of the Night and Matewan. You know, just really extraordinary cinematographer. Did a really cool documentary called Who Needs Sleep about how crew members are worked such long hours that they, like, get into car accidents or they have just health issues because they don't get enough sleep.
Our friends who work on crews are constantly exhausted when they're working.
Yeah, you know.
And when the job is over, when the series wraps or the movie wraps, they go into these sort of, like, cocoons of sleep for a week.
Yeah, because that's the economy of how these sets are set up, that you just have to work these long hours to make the day. You know? Anyway, Wexler is a genius, and I'm going to recommend a film that he directed that is considered a very kind of essential film of the kind of new Hollywood of the late 60s and early 70s. Yep. Medium Cool, which was a narrative film, but he shot a lot of it at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, and that's sort of the backdrop of the film. So there's a definite kind of documentary undercurrent to the film. And Criterion put out a very beautiful Blu-ray of that a while back. So that's my pick this week in honor of Mr. Wexler.
TCM Underground last night showed two Larry Cohen films in a back-to-back.
Oh, really?
It's Alive, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. Oh, yeah. And God Told Me To.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Like the long version or the director's cut or whatever?
I don't know.
Because there's two versions floating around.
Okay.
Interesting.
I know CineFamily is fond of showing God Told Me To at midnight.
Yes.
And I...
Did you TiVo God Told Me To?
Uh-huh.
Oh, good, because I'm going to see it.
Yeah. And so I don't know if either one of these is available on DVD, and I don't care. By any means necessary, watch It's Alive. It's about a monster baby, and it kills people and eats them, and it's amazing. And
there's something wrong with the Davis baby.
That's right.
It's Alive.
And so I probably actually have recommended It's Alive before on this podcast.
It's quite possible.
And I don't care about that either.
Fine.
So watch It's Alive, and once I get done watching God Told Me To,
We'll talk about that.
I'll let you know. Yeah.
Okay.
Here's some letters.
Yes.
Real.
Yes.
Yes. Hey, guys. Responding as asked. You don't have to read this on the show. But we're going to.
Yes.
You both are saying my name correctly. It is pronounced Real. Some people say Real, which is fine, too. I probably misspoke a little when I said I'm in the middle of nowhere. I am in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
It's kind of the middle of nowhere.
So it's not like I'm in a log cabin somewhere in the woods. I'm becoming more surprised how many smaller movies we are getting. Brooklyn just opened here, and I'm sure Hateful Eight will be behind it soon enough. Brooklyn is so good.
Oh, Brooklyn. It's adorable. We have several friends from Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And that's where Guy Madden's from, too.
This is from Jen. Alonzo and Dave, my wife gave me the very special version of the Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas book this morning. Thank you so much for all the little extras inside, which has become my favorite gift of the year. I felt like I was back in eighth grade listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped a whole sentence.
Yeah, the way.
You put in a little mix CD mm-hmm. in there for her, and... she said, while my kids finished demolishing their presents and was thrilled to have my Christmas mix curated by you, I felt like I was back in eighth grade, listening to a gifted mixtape, and each song made me swoon at how well my boyfriend knew me, so thank you. Is it too soon to put in my request for the Die Hard episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife? Thank you again, it was awesome.
Well, it's a little early because we haven't done it yet. Our goal was to do it before Christmas, but this December was bananas. But Die Hard is an anytime movie.
Goals are sometimes not met.
So we can do it.
Life, and that's
we'll do
life.
It soon, and it will still be good.
This is from Julia.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I don't have Dave's email, or I would have included it. I don't understand.
She sent a personal email to me.
She sent a personal email to you. Okay.
About the Star Wars episode.
Second, I loved the Star Wars podcast. I wanted to jump in. Here are my three items. I saw J.J. Abrams in a Q&A last Friday, and he made a comment that while Harrison Ford knew he was...
Is this a spoiler?
Yeah.
Okay.
Knew that this spoiler was going to happen. In the first big meeting they had with the cast, Harrison Ford leaned back in his chair and said to J.J. Abrams, I don't want that spoiler to happen.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Thing number two. I think Rey is some kind of Kenobi. Well, who knows?
Yeah.
And another spoiler. So, sorry, Julia.
Thanks for sharing. We're just not going to read it on the air.
This is from Rob. Hi, Alonzo and Dave. I'm a 20-year-old communication student from Dubbo, Australia. Is it Dubbo or Dubbo?
How's it spelled?
D-U-B-B-O.
Probably Dubbo, then.
I love the name Dubbo.
Dubbo.
I live in Dubbo. That's a great word. That's a great name for a place.
It's right up there with Cuba Petey.
Yeah. Currently on break from university, I've been enjoying listening to the back catalog of episodes whilst I've been home. The Australians and the Brits.
Whilst.
They say whilst. Still. As well as watching as many films as possible. Being in Australia, certain films haven't come out yet that may have appeared on the best of list. That's the thing. When you live in a different country,
yeah,
film releases are different. Blah, 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 things. These films aren't necessarily the best films to come out this year, but they did elicit a major positive or negative reaction. For me personally, best of 2015, his top 10 list,
mm-hmm.
Mad Max Fury Road.
Absolutely.
Room.
Mm.
The Gift.
Which I didn't see, but I hear is good.
Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Top 5, which was an Australian release in March.
It was all right.
I like Top 5 a lot. Dope, which is a fun little weird movie that people aren't really talking about.
Yeah. I didn't love Dope, but I liked Dope.
Creed.
Mm-hmm.
Straight out of Compton.
Mm-hmm.
Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm.
While We're Young.
Okay.
Worst. Hot Tub Time Machine 2.
Ugh.
Brr. Unfinished Business.
Blech.
The Ridiculous Six.
Blech.
Accidental Love. I don't know what that is.
That was the David O. Russell movie that he didn't get to finish.
Oh, okay.
Which I didn't see. I heard it was terrible.
Vacation.
Mm-hmm.
The Gunman.
Mm-hmm.
The Cobbler.
Mm-hmm.
50 Shades of Grey.
Mm-hmm.
Taken 3.
Mm-hmm.
/ Terminator Genesis / Ted 2. All in one go. And War Room.
Oof.
So here's the thing about War Room. Obviously, it is an amateurishly made film.
Mm-hmm.
But it marks a step in competency, improved competency.
In Christian movies.
In Christian films and among those specific filmmakers.
Right.
And it succeeds in doing what it sets out to do. I can't crap on it all that much.
Right.
It was not good.
Yeah.
And it's full of extreme magical thinking.
Is it better than Do You Believe?
Oh, yeah, quite much. Yeah, much better than Do You Believe. As a fan of movies, I find your podcast fantastic.
Well, thank you.
Entertainment. Not only does it inform me of some great films to check out, but the chemistry between the two of you is fantastic. Well,
yeah.
Because of love. I look forward to hearing more from you in 2016. Sincerely, Robert Crosby. Thank you, Robert Crosby.
Definitely read the Laura letter while we're talking about Star Wars, and I believe she made it a point to make it unspoilery.
Whoa, this is a long letter. I'm going to save it for next time. Yeah.
Why must you disobey me?
Because it's very long. Hang on. We're going to get to one that's shorter. And here is another list from Harold. Greetings, Alonzo and Dave. I found your podcast right after you were on the Sewers of Paris podcast. And it's great. I've been trolling back in time and randomly listening to your older shows. I wanted to thank Alonzo for turning me on to Carol for Another Christmas. It was on some list last year of overlooked Christmas specials. I wanted to send you a top 10 list, but it turned out to be too much pressure. There are lots of movies I love that I think are wonderful, but I don't seek them out very often. I guess I fall into the favorites side of that equation, so here are some of my favorites. The Women.
Okay.
Victor Victoria.
Sure.
Sunset Boulevard.
Yep.
Death Becomes Her.
I love Death Becomes Her.
That's what he's saying. Hear me out.
No, you do not need to explain yourself for Death Becomes Her. It's great.
Hello, Dolly.
That one, on the other hand.
All About Eve.
Mm-hmm.
GBF, our friend Darren Stein will be very happy to hear that. He says it's silly, but I enjoy it every time.
And George Nothe, who wrote it, is a sweetheart.
Yeah. Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
That's the list. 100% knife totally, on that list. Oh, and for the best and worst Australian.
Yes, also.
100%. You're both 100% knife.
I know people wanted us to talk about Room, and Dave hasn't watched it yet. I was not a giant fan. I didn't hate it, but I was just sort of...
I will now tell you a story.
Okay. Oh, please.
At a Christmas event recently... some people were telling me how much I needed to see Room.
Mm-hmm.
And across the room that I was in,
mm-hmm.
Someone else, a film critic, was overhearing this conversation and making direct eye contact with me and shaking his head.
I think I know who you're talking about.
And so... Of course, I mean, I'm going to watch it because the split between friends who are, like, overwhelmingly on its side.
Oh, all three of my What the Flick co-hosts gave it a 10.
And the other people I know who are like, mm-mm, nope, not this one.
Well, and even those people are like, well, she's good.
And but. I respect the opinions of all these people, and so I just have to... I gotta watch it. We have a DVD, don't we?
We do.
Didn't they send it to us?
Yes, okay, yes. Yeah, that's right. How I watched it.
Okay, so we're done.
Golly. Okay, so yeah, as we said, we're running behind on the Die Hard commentary, but we will
we're not
get to
running
it
behind.
Soon.
We're taking our time.
We're running behind.
We're doing it.
We promised it for Christmas and we did not deliver, but we will deliver it soon. But in the meantime...
You'll get it when you get it.
In the meantime, there are 10 other Linoleum Night Presents
More Linoleum Knife
episodes for you to invest in. They're $1.99 each. You can PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com and make sure you include your email address so I know where to send it. They include such favorites as Clue, Josie and the Pussycats, Gentlemen for Blondes, What's Up Doc, The Poseidon Adventure, Two for the Road, The Apple, and something, and then the two Christmas episodes, which is a little late for now. Anyway, so there's that, and of course, you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. Thank you to Pedro Canena for, and I hope I said that right, for the wonderful review. If you have not reviewed the program yet, it helps us a great deal to go and leave a review on iTunes. It helps sort of lift us up in the morass of many, many podcasts out there for people to be looking for. You can also stream the show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. I want to thank Blue for our theme music and remind you, of course, to check out our friends in the podcast universe. Go listen to the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney and Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley and the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Gray and Matt. Go check out ChristyLemire.com. Listen to The Sewers of Paris, where Dave and I appear on the Christmas episode talking about our favorite Christmas stuff that just went up this past week. And all the other ones that I always mention. I don't have the piece of paper in front of me, but you know who they are. Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. And thank you all for a great year. This, you know, we hit our fifth anniversary this year. We made the AV Club poll of shows they should be talking about next year. You guys have been very enthusiastic in your response to stuff like, you know, the extra episodes and the Dave's audiobook and, you know, my Christmas book.
We really, 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 really like you.
Don't fall over. I get gun shy about that song next. You're going to take out another magazine rack. Anyway, we're when people talk about gratitude at the end of the year, it's a little barfy, but we really are grateful for your support and your ongoing, all the nice things that people say about the show.
I write about it in my gratitude journal
The way that people recommend the show to other folks, the enthusiasm that we've already been getting from people about the subscription plan, which we're going to do soon, we promise. And remember that this show will always, always be free. The subscription plan will get you other stuff like LKTV and things that will be available only to subscribers, but this show, this podcast of the cinema, will always be free.
Never forget.
That's right. So everybody have a great rest of the year. Enjoy, get some holiday time in there. Hopefully you're not like completely slammed. And wishing everybody a great 2016. It's going to be
lie down.
2016 is going to be an exciting year for the show. We're going to have a lot of new ventures that we try out. But we hope it's a great year for you.
I'm going to stay lying down all through 2016.
We hope it's a great year for you, and we hope it's a great year for us. Obviously,
I'm going to get bed sores because I'm lying down the whole time.
That's exciting.
You're going to have to hire someone to come in and clean and cook. I'm just going to lie down.
I'm going to smother you with a pillow. Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.